Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says International Quds Day this year will be held even more gloriously as non-Muslim nations will also be participating in the event. And also in our headlines, Russia says UN Security Council's failure to condemn an attack on Israel's embassy in Syria serves as a clear illustration of double standards employed by the West. Our top story for this half hour. The Israeli regime presses ahead with its relentless airstrikes and artillery shelling of the besieged Gaza Strip nearly 6 months into its genocidal war. The regime's latest bombing of a house in the southern city of Rafah killed 4 people, including 2 infants. Elsewhere in Rafah, several Palestinians were killed and wounded after Israeli jets targeted another residential building. A series of Israeli raids left at least 2 Palestinians dead and over a dozen wounded in Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza and Deir al-Bala. Several people were killed and dozens injured as a result of the regime's raids. Over 33,000 people have so far been killed and over 75,600 injured since Israel began its Gaza genocide early last October. For nearly the past 6 months, Israel has been using starvation as a weapon of war against Palestinians. For 2 million hungry Gazans, most days bring a difficult search for something to eat. Thousands of them are also forced to make treacherous journey to get flour from aid trucks amid Israel's relentless bombing and shelling campaign. Let's take a listen to some of the Gazans who explain their sufferings and how they struggle to get flour for daily bread.
We wait all night for this flour. We sleep on the streets, in the cold, on the sand, enduring hardship to secure food for our families, especially our young children. I don't know what else to do or how our lives have come to this. We implore the world to empathize with our plight.
I spent the night on Kuwait roundabout to secure this bag of flour. It was a lot of hardship, but I thank God and everyone who aids the Gaza Strip.
We were going to get flour, and we have been at this checkpoint for 2 days now. We are facing delays in flour delivery, and there's a shortage. It's not just flour, there's also a scarcity of vegetables, meats, and other essentials like legumes, lentils, and chickpeas.
On this segment of the program, the founder of the U.S.-based charity World Central Kitchen has criticized Israel over the killing of his staff in Gaza, saying the regime's forces systematically targeted a convoy carrying aid workers. Jose Andres said that cars were hit purposefully, one after the other, in a civilian area under the control of the Israeli army. He held Israel responsible for the killing, which he said was not the outcome of a bad luck situation. He added the Israeli forces were well informed about the convoy's movement and that the cars were clearly marked with the charity's logo. The strike killed 6 foreign aid workers and their Palestinian translators. 60% of non-governmental aid getting into the besieged strip is from the World Central Kitchen. The charity has suspended its operations in Gaza following the attack. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and commentator Tashriq Trubadi joining us from Cape Town, also a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement. Booker Ngessa is joining us from Nairobi. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Trubadi in Cape Town. The Israelis, since this Gaza genocide started, have killed around 200 aid workers. That is no accident, is it?
It isn't, and there's a couple of issues, I think, with the way in which the story is also being covered, in that it, of course, is an absolute tragedy. I have no doubt that these aid workers were good souls, they were good human beings that had been determined to bring relief to Palestinians that are having to endure a genocide at the moment in Gaza. And while their death, as in any death, is a tragedy, I do think we need to contrast the Western government responses here to the realities that Palestinian lives are not quite as equally important, in the outrage that we're now seeing here from some of these governments. These governments, of course, also now finding their voice because of the domestic responses in some of these countries that are increasingly now leading to a push for not just a ceasefire, but holding these governments accountable for funding and propping up the Zionist entity. So there's a very serious and a big worry about the manner in which the humanity of the Palestinians aren't quite seen as much as we've now seen with these aid workers. And I think the attack in and of itself is not just proven to be deliberate, because yes, the vehicles did have their logo, yes, the vehicles did drive in convoy, but these vehicles were coming from a warehouse where the aid was being offloaded, they were being unpacked, and they were on their way back. They were supposedly in what we call, in inverted commas, a deconflicted zone. Their movements were communicated to the occupation army. So this was not just deliberate, but I do believe an intimidation tactic to not allow aid to continue to flow into Gaza, which is why ships have turned away, which is why aid was suspended, which is why the Israelis fundamentally do not want to give aid to the very people they've called animals. So I don't quite think it was just a routine mistake or a routine deliberate attack. I do think there was an agenda here with this particular attack, especially as we increasingly now talking about a potential escalation with boots on the ground in Rafah. So I think it was more than deliberate. It was seeking to send a message.
Right. And let's cross over to Mr. Ngessa. As we were mentioning in our intro, around 60% of non-governmental aid getting into the besieged strip was reported to be from the World Central Kitchen. As a result of the attack, the charity has suspended its operations in Gaza. Is that what the Israelis were aiming for?
Yeah, thank you. And first of all, the situation in Gaza is very dire. The famine situation is very, very dire, and this is because this is not a natural disaster, but it is a situation that has been artificially created by the Israel regime, and within it, policy of even attacking humanitarian organizations who dare to correct, the famine has been caused by the genocidal attacks on Gaza. The Zionist regime, who is actually not just complicit, but advancing the policy of genocide against Palestinian people, do not want aid to reach where it is needed most. In fact, we have seen before the Zionist regime tolerating, people, Israeli people blocking aid from reaching Gaza. So it actually brings the policy within the Israeli administration of collective punishment that not even medicine or water should reach the people of Gaza, in the name of defeating not the Hamas people, but defeating the spirit of the Palestinian people who are fighting for just the their statehood, their rule, and the right to land. This policy of collective punishment is now being seen when aid organizations are militarily being targeted by such a regime that is complicit and also advancing the policy of genocide against the Palestinian people. The second is, if indeed the Israeli regime supported by the United States was interested of aid getting into Gaza, then they should be the first people to support any humanitarian organizations that tries to reach the people who direly need help within the Gaza Strip. But all this is a show-off. Remember, a few weeks ago, there has been some airdroppings of some food and help to the Gaza Strip. This is just for propaganda, because when the human rights organizations within tries to reach Gaza, or even trucks delivery of food, is being blocked and militarily targeted. And then 2 or 3 days later, we see, you know, air droppings of very limited, a very limited help to Gaza. And in fact, even during the air droppings, the Zionist regime even continues to shoot people who are actually only waiting for the aid to come to them. This is the psyche of the Israeli politicians, that the Palestinians do not deserve to live with dignity. And they continue to advance that policy of genocide. And that is what the people see. That though the United States of America continue to claim that the Israeli regime should not target civilians, but their complicits, in fact, them with their so-called civilized West, are actually equipping the current, you know, targets of the aid organizations. Maybe what kind of equipment was used to hit those aid organizations? They were probably supplied by German organizations or United States organizations. And this is what the world should be angry at.
Thank you, gentlemen. That was Booker and Guest, a member of the Kenya-Palestine Solidarity Movement, joining us from Nairobi. And thanks to journalist and commentator Tashreeq Truebody, speaking to us from Cape Town. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says this year's International Quds Day will be a global uproar against the Zionist regime, in which people in non-Muslim countries will also participate. In a meeting with heads of the three branches of the government, Ayatollah Khamenei said the Israeli regime will continue to be the losing party in the Gaza Strip. He added the regime's recent crime against Iranian military advisors in Syria will not save it from defeat. In the Palestinian territory, Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the Israeli regime will be punished for the aggression. International condemnation followed the Israeli airstrike against the consular section of Iran's embassy in the Syrian capital. The European Union was the latest to join calls to condemn the attack after multiple countries, including Iraq, Venezuela, Oman, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, China, and Russia, denounced the Israeli aggression as unacceptable. Syrians have paid homage to the 7 military advisors who were killed in Monday's Israeli attack on the consular section of Iran's diplomatic mission in Damascus. Let's take a listen to some of those who attended the funeral ceremony on Wednesday.
The blood that was shed represents the blood of all the free people. Let the Zionist enemy know that victory is certain and the revenge of the resistance fighters is coming. If Haji Ahmad Mughniyeh left behind thousands of fighters, Haji Abu Mahdi left behind hundreds of thousands of fighters and precision missiles that will eradicate the occupying usurping entity. We will surely prevail with the help of Allah Almighty.
There is nothing better than a path written with the blood of martyrs, and no revelation greater than the souls of our martyrs and those who came before them. They have left an indelible legacy for this nation that can never be forgotten, and those who follow in their footsteps will never be misguided. As President Hafez al-Assad said about them, the martyrs are the most honorable in this world and the noblest of human beings.
The light of matters blood has always been the guiding path for humanity towards its salvation. These martyrs who came from different corners of the earth, from Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon, sacrificed themselves in defense of Islam and Sayyidina Zainab, peace be upon her. They aspired for martyrdom to attain this high status with Allah Almighty, and we will continue their path until the liberation of Al-Aqsa.
Russia says a failure by the U.S., Britain, and France to condemn the recent Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus is a clear illustration of their double standards. In a social media post, Russia's deputy ambassador to the U.N. said the stance of these countries exposes their approach to legality and order in the international context. Dmitry Polyansky added Washington and London even refused to discuss a draft statement, which is a traditional norm in such cases. On Tuesday, most Security Council members except the U.S., Britain, France, condemned the Israeli regime for its airstrikes on the Iranian embassy. A day later, the European Union also deplored the attack, arguing that the inviolability of diplomatic and consular premises and personnel must be respected in all circumstances. Monday's attack on the embassy in Damascus killed two senior Iranian military commanders and five accompanying officers who were on an advisory mission to Syria. Iranian officials have announced an end to clashes between security forces and terrorists in the southeastern provinces of Sistan and Baluchistan. The commander of the IRGC ground forces said 15 assailants were killed following their simultaneous attacks against police and military posts in the cities of Rosk and Chabahar on Wednesday night. He said three others are surrounded and are expected to capture soon, dead or alive, adding that the mop-up operation is still underway. Five Iranian security forces also lost their lives, and 10 others were injured, according to local officials. The terrorists were affiliated with Pakistan-based Jaish al-Adl terror outfit that had carried out several similar attacks in the past. The group claimed responsibility for an attack in December on a police station in Rosk that killed at least 11 officers. In January, another attack by the group left a policeman dead. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
The Zionist regime military has withdrawn from the Gaza Strip's largest hospital after a two-week raid, leaving behind scenes of devastation. Hundreds of people returned to Ashifa Hospital and the surrounding area after the withdrawal recently. They reported finding bodies strewn inside and outside the facility. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with three eyewitnesses, including two journalists, who were met with scenes of absolute devastation when they reached the vicinity of the Ashifa Hospital. At dawn, April 1st, Israeli occupation forces suddenly withdrew from the Ashifa medical complex following a two-week siege and constant attacks. When they learned about the withdrawal, Gaza City residents converged on the area west of Gaza City to survey the damage caused by the Zionist regime incursion and to assess the conditions of their homes, which they were forced to evacuate. What they encountered was shocking. Palestinian journalist Badr Abdul Allah told the Palestine Chronicle, "Everything in the complex is destroyed. All the buildings of the hospital were bombed and are no longer usable." He noted, "The Ashrafal Medical Complex is the largest hospital in the Gaza Strip, and it is the lifeline of the health sector in Gaza." Adel Aul told Palestine Chronicle, "But now it is destroyed, and the occupation has completely taken it out of service. Israel must be held accountable for the crimes it committed in Ashrafa." He continued, "All media outlets documented the crimes throughout these months, and they are still there. This crime, however, cannot pass without accountability. The occupation has violated everything in the Gaza Strip, and nobody in the world seems to be determined to stop them. Rather, major global powers are complicit and partners in massacring our Palestinian people." Ayman Hatou is another journalist who witnessed the degree of devastation left behind by the Israeli regime army. He compared the obliteration to what he saw last November when Israeli regime forces stormed the complex for the first time. Hatou told the Palestine Chronicle, "In November, the destruction was confined to the external areas and only part of the building were damaged." He added, "We did not expect all of this. This time, the Israeli army left destruction and devastation in all the buildings of the complex. They were all bombed and burnt. There is no usable building or floor." Hatou noted, "The scene that appeared in front of us this morning was like the destruction caused by the Mongols who invaded Iraq hundreds of years ago. This time around, however, everything was documented by cameras. It is crystal clear that the Israeli army is the most unethical army in the world. They have no red lines." Abu Anas al-Shanshiri is a resident of Gaza City. His son Anas and his daughter Aisha were killed nearly 3 months ago by an Israeli regime strike, and their bodies were buried in the courtyard of Ashrafa. He told the Palestine Chronicle, "I couldn't find a place to bury them at that time. We were forced to bury them in the medical complex, and I used to visit their graves regularly." Al-Shanshiri hoped that the bodies remained there so that he could bury them in a cemetery after the end of the war. He said, "When I learned that the occupation had stormed Ashrafa 2 weeks ago, I followed the news obsessively. My biggest fear was that they would dig up graves and remove bodies from the courtyard. But when I rushed there this morning, the destruction and devastation I witnessed cannot be described. If an earthquake had struck the complex, it would have been less devastating than the ruins left by the occupation." Al-Shanshiri reached the place where his son and daughter were buried, only to find a hole amid the rubble and the destruction. He said in tears, "I couldn't find the bodies of my children, and I could not locate their whereabouts." He continued, "Perhaps the occupation forces took them, or perhaps their bulldozers swept them away and moved them under the rubble to other places in the complex. I'm still searching, hoping to find them. The atrocities they committed in Ashrafa, including my digging up graves, are simply unspeakable." Meanwhile, Press TV reported the Gaza Health Ministry says Israeli forces have withdrawn tanks and vehicles from Gaza's main hospital, Ashrafa, after a two-week siege of the medical complex. In a statement recently, the ministry said dozens of bodies, some of them decomposed, had been found at the complex after the Zionist regime pulled out, which also left behind a vast swath of destruction. It emphasized that Israel retreated from the hospital after burning burning down the complex buildings and putting it completely out of service, the ministry said. The scale of the destruction inside the complex and the buildings around it is very large. All buildings in the hospital were exposed to fire or sustained damage, including the mortuary and the hospital's courtyards and corridors. The Israeli regime military also confirmed withdrawal from the hospital. The Gaza government's media office said dozens of Israeli airstrikes and shells around the complex have provided cover for the withdrawing vehicles. The Zionist regime first raided the hospital in Gaza City last November. On March 18th, Israeli occupation forces started a new wave of attacks on the medical complex and imposed a siege on it. Ashrafa, Gaza's largest hospital, has sheltered thousands of Palestinians who fled Israel's invasion in the northern parts of the territory. The Zionist regime military claimed that the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is using the facility to conduct and promote territory activity. Hamas has repeatedly denied operating from Ashrafa and other health facilities. A doctor said more than 20 bodies had been recovered from Ashrafa Hospital and that some had been crushed by withdrawing vehicles. The Zionist regime unleashed its brutal U.S.-backed war on the Gaza Strip on October 7th after Hamas carried out a historic operation against a usurping entity in retaliation for the regime's intensified atrocities against the Palestinian people. However, more than 6 months into the offensive, the Tel Aviv regime has failed to achieve its objectives of destroying Hamas and finding Israeli captives, despite killing at least 32,782 Palestinians, mostly women and children, and injuring 75,298 others. Around 1.4 million people who fled their homes elsewhere in Gaza have sought shelter in Rafah, the only part of the territory Israeli troops have yet to enter. Washington has nonetheless approved billions of dollars worth of bombs and fighter jets for Israel in recent days, the Wall Street Journal reported, citing unnamed officials.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iraq, Pakistan, Oman, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Cuba, Venezuela, China, and Russia have all slammed the Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy in Damascus, Syria. Yet the so-called flag bearers of international law and conventions in the West have kept mum about Israel's blatant violation of international law. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has vowed that Tehran will make the occupation regime regret its deadly airstrike on the Iran embassy in Damascus. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's get us started. These are my guests in this episode of The Spotlight. Vanessa Bila, independent journalist, is joining me out of Damascus. Also with us is Richard Merthurst. He's a journalist and commentator in Vienna.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of this story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, welcome to the show. Now, beginning with Vanessa, let's first talk about what the motive could be behind this operation. The majority, actually, of the experts and analysts that we've spoken to, speaking of provoking Iran, Israel trying to provoke Iran into engaging in war so that Israel could spread further instability and insecurity across the region. Your thought on this?
Well, I think just before Christmas last year, Yoav Gallant made it quite clear that they needed a victory in this war in order to survive. So in the Middle East, so this is an existential war for Israel. It's been evident since October the 7th that they are desperately losing the war in Gaza against a relatively ill-equipped Palestinian resistance. They have had to evacuate from the northern occupied territories more than 100,000 settlers, as far as we know, in the contained war against Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And so now they deem it necessary to expand the war, particularly into Syria, because we have to remember that this is the fourth in a series of attacks in the last 7 days. And all of these attacks have been carried out in conjunction with an upsurge in attacks by the terrorist groups across all the axes, particularly in the northwest and in central Syria. So, you know, the masks have fallen. People can now see exactly who is the real axis of evil in the region, the real axis of terrorism. Those that are silent about this appalling attack, people in Damascus, are still in shock that this has actually happened. I mean, this is an escalation beyond expectations. So Israel wants to expand the war. The resistance axis has been trying to restrict that expansion, but it remains to be seen if that remains the status quo.
All right. Now, let me turn to Vienna. Richard, the UK just a couple of hours ago summoned the Israeli ambassador, and that because three British aid workers got killed in Gaza. Now, when it comes to proportionality, you tell me, what is then Iran entitled to do now that it's lost several of its senior nuclear scientists and also military commanders at the hands of the Israeli regime?
Well, the Israelis want the Iranians to turn this into a full-blown war because it would suit them. But I think, you know, the axis of resistance, not just Iran, but all of the resistance have proven over time that they are not ones to be tricked or to fall into traps. Although it's understandable that Iran's response should be just disproportionate. I think that, as Iran have said, and they always respond and they will do it at the right time. Regarding the British summoning over the killing of three aid workers, what's interesting is that we have a chorus. We have all of these Western officials talking about the World Central Kitchen issue in Gaza, which is important. But they're doing that to avoid talking about this unprecedented attack on the embassy. I mean, speaking of proportionality, we have to talk about this more because, you know, we've never seen a so-called state attacking the embassy of another state in a third state. I mean, this is a violation of the UN Charter. It's a violation of the Vienna Convention, the Geneva Convention. It's so egregious. It's unprecedented. The fact that the British government don't even care enough to summon the Israelis over that alone, or any other ambassadors that are in Europe or the West to be summoned over this issue is scandalous, and it really shows you where their priorities lie.
Right. Now, Vanessa, some observers citing the reason for Israel to do this as an act of desperation, and that's mostly thanks to the failures it's facing in Gaza. It's not been able to defeat one single resistance group in Palestinian occupied territories, you know, and also maybe these anti-Netanyahu protests on the home turf, you know, a host of, you know, issues, the Israeli economy and all that. Do you share the same view?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, you know, Israel is not only losing the strategic and military war, it's losing desperately the propaganda war, its entire edifice of propaganda that has propped it up for since its creation as a illegal settler colonialist state by the British, and then of course it was adopted by the states. The entire anti-Semitism trope has been destroyed, particularly of course by the case of Professor David Miller, that has now stated very clearly that being anti-Zionism is acceptable. And you know, their entire defense for this genocide that they're committing, not only in Gaza but in the West Bank, which is based upon an entire series of lies that they produced from October the 7th onwards that have now gradually been completely debunked. The world is seeing them as they are. And their economy has taken a massive hit. Military morale is at its lowest. Settlers are leaving the Zionist entity itself. And the Zionist entity can only survive with settler support. So if settlers are starting to decide that it's no longer offering them security, they will leave. And then what is left? And also, you know, which country in its right mind now is going to be looking at investment in the future in a country that is clearly responsible for genocide of Palestinians across the territories?
Now, Richard, why shouldn't they learn a lesson from their past mistakes? Like when they assassinated Iran General Soleimani, what did they gain? The resistance front even got stronger and got, you know, a boost in the arm. Now they are again killing Iranian commanders at a lower level compared to General Soleimani, the icon of the anti-terror and anti-Daesh, actually, in this part of the world.
I mean, without question, they gained nothing. The resistance got stronger. We can see the same pattern with Hamas, for example, when the Israelis thought, okay, if they assassinate Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, that this will, destroy Hamas. Look at Hamas today. I mean, they've launched a full-blown war, and they can't even defeat them. So imagine with Iran how much stronger that is. It's, you know, the axis of resistance has shown over time that no matter what actions the Israelis and Americans take, they are losing on the chessboard. They simply cannot get around the failures that they are, you know, experiencing at home, so to speak, and on the battlefield. And this is actually why they assassinate. They lash out like a cat, you know, clawing someone, because they are terrorists deep down. This is who they really are. And it's not just the assassination of the high-ranking officials here. It's really, we have to understand this as an attack on Iran itself, because that's really what it is. You know, the Israelis have done this, these attacks on Iran and its sovereignty before, and the same thing with Syria, but this is on an unprecedented level. And, we look at the terror at Al-Shifa Hospital. This is something, in my opinion, that they were trying to hide and distract from. But again, it's on a deeper level here. The Israelis are trying to find some kind of victory. They think that they can overcome their failures by assassinating people, and it's not going to happen. And I should point something out, that they are doing this on multiple levels. We had a terrorist attack in January in Iran, which ISIS supposedly claimed responsibility for it. Mm-hmm. We had another ISIS attack in Russia. We had a recent terrorist attack in China. Do we really think this is a coincidence that there are all these assassinations? General Mousavi is another one, Saleh Haruri, and all these terrorist attacks by ISIS and Al-Qaeda who are known to have links to America and Israel. It's not a coincidence.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Vanessa, Richard mentioned something, and what the Israeli regime did is actually a violation of Iran. It means an attack on Iran because a sovereign country's diplomatic premises was targeted and hit. It was also the host country, so it's a violation of international law and conventions because it was diplomatic premises. Both, you know, the host country was violated, and also Iran. So who should hold this regime accountable for such an action?
Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, the Iranian foreign minister was quite clear that he holds Washington responsible. Washington, the UK, and the EU, and the allies of Israel have continued supplying weapons to Israel to conduct and carry out the genocidal campaign in Palestine, right. But they're also supplying the weapons to carry out these kind of assassinations. And it, as you've mentioned, it's not the first, particularly on Syrian territory. And this was what made it even more heinous for me and why everybody here is still in shock. This was around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so 2 hours before Iftar, the breaking of fast during Ramadan. Right. It was packed full of people, the equivalent to Oxford Circus, in London, and as you said, it targets what is effectively a diplomatic zone. It was the consular section, which is actually the residence, if I understand it, of the ambassador. Mm-hmm. General Zahedi was there under diplomatic immunity. So this is actually a terrorist act. I mean, I consider Israel to be a terrorist state anyway for all of its other actions, but this was a clear, under international law, a terrorist act. And yet there has been the only country calling for an emergency session at the UN Security Council is Russia. The West is saying absolutely nothing. In response, for example, the US State Department spokesperson mumbled his way through his usual excuses for Israel. And this is appalling because this is plunging us into an abyss of global insecurity. The last time that this kind of act took place was a bombing by the U.S. of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, which killed three Chinese diplomats, for which the U.S. apologized and said it was a mistake. Whether we believe that or not is by the by. Mm-hmm. But this is unbelievable. Israel is pushing the boundaries of all conventions, human rights conventions, Geneva conventions, Vienna conventions, and yet the response, imagine if, for example, Russia had bombed a U.S. embassy on another country's territory, what would the response be? We would be at war now.
Exactly. Now, Richard, Vanessa mentioned the role of the U.S., so to what extent could Washington be blamed for such acts that would further actually embolden the Tel Aviv regime to perpetrate more such crimes? Also, let's bear in mind that it was U.S.-made fighter jets, it was F-35 jets performing the strikes against the Iranian embassy.
The U.S. are absolutely responsible. It's as if an American pilot dropped it himself. The U.S. Air Force dropped it themselves. There is absolutely no distinction here. And we really need to be clear on this. The United States and Israel are one, and they attacked Iran together. The munitions, the payloads, the ordnances, every nut and bolt in that fighter jet and the six missiles that were fired were manufactured by American companies. The U.S. government manufactured this and gave an export license and permission to give this to the Zionists. And then said nothing and continues to say nothing after, you know, we have diplomats killed. I mean, even if nobody was killed, the symbolic act of attacking an embassy is outrageous. It is beyond, it is unconscionable. It is truly beyond words. I still can't digest it, you know, even after 24 hours. It is so outrageous. And as Vanessa pointed out, the Israelis, I mean, is there a law that they haven't broken in any jurisdiction, under any convention? I don't know at this point. But the Americans have to be held responsible. And you know, a proper government, a real government, a one that cares about international law, a civilized government, would have immediately, you know, cut ties with the Israelis a long time ago, by the way. But after this act, let's say, cut ties and cut exports and, you know, held an emergency session, called for an emergency session at the UN Security Council and apologized for providing these weapons.
Right. Now, Vanessa, there were multiple countries that, and international bodies, including the United Nations, for instance, they've all condemned this Israeli act of terrorism, except the West. So what is this indicative of?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, you know, the masks are off. The fact that these U.S.-backed Zionist attacks on Syrian territory against Iranian military, against Hezbollah, against the Islamic resistance, against Syrian Arab army forces and national defense forces, because as I said, we shouldn't forget Israel carried out the attack in the northeast. Israel violated Syrian airspace and targeted east and west of Aleppo, enabling a terrorist attack on the western Aleppo axis. It carried out an attack on the Research and Development Center in Jamraya on the morning of this assassination. There, the fires were burning for more than 6 hours. And then finally, this assassination. So in 1 week, you know, Israel has violated, it's effectively declared war multiple times, and it's only because of the restraint of the resistance axis that we are not right now in a full-blown global war. And the thing is that Israel keeps pushing, it keeps provoking, and even though the response from the resistance has been very much a deterrent response, right, which is understandable, where do we go next? Are they going to bomb the presidential palace? Mm-hmm. Are they going to bomb central Tehran? I mean, this is the thing. To what extent are Israel going to push this? Yep. To what extent do they want to expand this war?
Yeah, I don't think they dare to do that in a way. Now, Richard, no. Tel Aviv, what is it doing exactly? Is it playing global bully, an outlaw or rogue regime? What is it that Israel is exactly doing, given all the crimes it's been committing in Gaza, this recent terrorist attack at Iran embassy? Is there anything on the planet that is not viable for this regime? And then they depict Iran as a menace to regional security.
No, there is nothing that the Zionists will not do. What's funny to me is that today you can be arrested on the streets of London for saying you support Hamas or you support the Palestinian resistance. Mm. And the police who arrest you for this would have been killed by the Israelis a few decades ago because this is the nature of the Israelis, and they have done this. So, you know, whether we look at the attacks on Iran, the attacks on Britain, there's a history since the very beginning, going back a century, of the Israelis behaving in this. They have effectively invented modern terrorism, and I really mean that in the literal full sense of the term. The Israelis invented modern terrorism. They started mailing parcel bombs, letter bombs, planting bombs around London. Why wouldn't they bomb their neighbors? This is how they stole the land, is it not?
Right.
And so because Iran is the only one helping everyone to stand up for themselves and defend themselves, they try and go after Iran. It's that simple. There's no other explanation.
So, Richard, we have just 1 minute. So, Vanessa, what do you see on the horizon for the West Asia region, given all this warmongering by the U.S. and Israel?
I think escalation is almost unavoidable. I mean, as I said, inside Syria now we have an increase in the terrorist attack across all axes. Really, everybody is waiting to see what Iran's response will be, and then, of course, how the Zionists will respond to that. So I think we're in abeyance, but I think we're preparing for further escalation.
Okay. That's all the time we have for this episode. Thank you so much, Vanessa Billy, in Damascus, Richard Methurst in Vienna.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahl bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety. This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Warahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace be upon the Imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, His select, His party, the case of His knowledge, His argument, His path, His light, His proof. Allah's mercy and blessings to be upon them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. And in one of these very long conversations that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his companions, and most probably, I think, it is related that it is a companion from Ahwaz, and it's amazing because this companion must have been a very close companion of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, because the conversation is a very, very lengthy conversation. But there's different themes that come out from this conversation. In one such place, we have Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam talks about how Allah the Almighty has not put some kind of a watcher or a guardian or a preventer over human beings that will prevent them from carrying out what Allah has ordered them to do. Now, the context of the whole conversation is something which we don't have time to delve into, but what we do want to kind of understand and pick out from at least this, you know, very short statement is that there is nothing, you know, that Allah has ordained which prevents us from fulfilling our duties and our obligations and from fulfilling those things which Allah has ordered us to do. So I guess there's different points that we learn from this. The first point, of course, is that if we ourselves, you know, the individual is the one who either makes excuses or brings up, you know, illegitimate reasons or prevents their own self from following and obeying the orders of the Almighty Allah. So the first individual that we must look towards, and perhaps ultimately the only individual that we must look towards when we are looking for who to blame when it comes to the disobedience of the Almighty Allah, is ourself. You know, sometimes we kind of have a tendency to blame everything on shaitan or the shayateen, the devils, and, you know, from the jinn and the men. Yes, they have their own place, and they insinuate one, they push one, they egg one on, as it is, you know, commonly referred to as said. But that's all that it is. It's kind of a poking you in the ribs to kind of get a reaction from you. But ultimately, you know, with the help of the Almighty Allah, of course, you know, we will see that ultimately, with the help of Allah, we can withstand that poking of the devils in their various different forms. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it is us as individuals, you know, who unfortunately end up deciding to disobey the Almighty Allah. And as Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has said, that Allah has not put anything or anyone over us which will prevent us from doing that which we must do or from not doing that which we must not do. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi, alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget